Well, good morning, church. It's so good to be with you. My name is Kevin Sneed. I'm the teaching pastor here at CPC. And today we're actually finishing our five-week vision series. And we've entitled this series, Becoming the People of God. And we really believe this has been an important series in the life of our church. What we've been trying to do is lay out where God is leading us as a community of faith for the next 4 to 5 years together. One of the phrases we use around here often is that we want to become a transformed people, transforming the peninsula. And that's really our vision. And we've been in this series asking the question of how. How do we become a transformed people, transforming the peninsula? Well, a few weeks ago, we preached a sermon that really was trying to take this idea of discipleship, this ancient tool that Jesus has used for centuries, that the church has used for centuries, to follow more closely to Jesus. And we kind of layered a metaphor onto that and said the best modern equivalent of this term discipleship is actually this idea of apprenticeship. And what we've done is kind of tried to lift that metaphor of apprenticeship up and place it onto Jesus so that we, as followers of Jesus, are something more akin to apprentices of Jesus. And in that sermon, we laid out that the two goals of an apprentice, regardless of craft or tradition or whatever it is, when you apprentice under someone, you have two primary goals. The first is to be present to your teacher, and the second is to participate in the work of your teacher. So we talked through what that would look like then to be present to Jesus, our master teacher, and then to participate in the work that Jesus is on about in the world around us. And so as apprentices of Jesus, this is where we believe God is leading us, is to become apprentices of Him who are present and participate with Jesus in the work that He's on about. And you know, every era of church history kind of poses particular challenges and obstacles to following Jesus in that time. And so the issue of how we go about doing that is actually as old as time. There's nothing new under the sun. And so for us, what is comforting as we come to this moment in history and say, how do we follow Jesus? How do we apprentice under Jesus in our day and age? We actually have a rich history to look back on and see how the church over the centuries has wrestled with this question. And what we found is what has developed over time is a tool that dates back far before our modern era that the church has cultivated, which is what we called a rule of life. And a rule of life is something similar to what a trellis is to a grapevine. The goal is not the trellis, right? The trellis, all it does is it's a tool to lift the grapevine up off the ground and allow it to flourish. And so in the same way, a rule of life is what a trellis is to a grapevine, a rule of life is to the apprentice of Jesus. It's a way of life, a set of practices that lifts our life up off of the chaos of our moment and allows us to then flourish in the way of Jesus. A few weeks ago, we called a rule of life this. We said, a rule of life is a set of practices that organize and orient the habits of our regular days to help us practice presence with Jesus and participation in His work in the world. And so where we believe God is leading us as a church is to organize our community of faith around a shared rule of life, a shared set of practices and habits that lifts up our individual and collective lives together as a way of kind of intentionally following Jesus in our time. So in that, we've identified 4 practices that we believe are part of our rule of life. The first one is this. It's the practice of attentiveness. And we practice attentiveness in contrast to a world of distraction and hurry. And this morning, we're actually going to talk a whole lot about that. This sermon really sets us up for where we're going. Next Sunday, we're going to launch our first habit series where we look at particularly the habit of silence and solitude that enables us to practice attentiveness. And so today we'll unpack that a lot. But the second practice is this. We practice renewing the mind in contrast to a world of noise, competing narratives, and addictions. We believe, like Paul in Romans 12, who said, do not be conformed to the patterns of this world, but rather be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And as we practice renewing the mind, we learn new habits, new ways that it almost integrates into the very mental maps of our brain that allow us to connect ourselves with that true story, that true narrative of the gospel. So the third practice in our rule of life is hospitality. And we practice hospitality in contrast to a world of hostility, division, and isolation. We believe in an increasingly polarized world that we live in, that one of the fundamental things we as followers of Jesus can do to subvert that sort of sway towards hostility is by practicing hospitality, by welcoming the other, by eating with those far from Jesus, by having a gentle, almost like a winsomeness in the way we encounter those who think differently than us. And then lastly, our fourth practice in our rule of life is that of vocation. And we practice vocation in contrast to a world of compulsive consumption. That we as followers of Jesus believe that to participate in the work that Jesus is on about, we must learn to view our life, our resources, our skills, our talents, everything as a sort of open-handed gift that we give back to the world around us. And so this morning we are wrapping up this series and we're focusing on really what does it mean to be present to Jesus? What does it mean to start this first practice of attentiveness and launch us into this new season of life? But before we jump into that, I want to give you a few thoughts on the why. In 2007, the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor wrote his magnum opus, A Secular Age. And in this book, I mean, it's 800 pages of sort of dense philosophical, sociological history, and if I'm honest, it's brutal to try to get through. But in this book, Taylor is asking the question, why 500 years ago, when you were born, the default setting of kind of what it meant to be human was to believe in the divine. It was just simply a sort of taken for grantedness of nature. You would just wake up and belief in the divine was the default setting of what it meant to be human. Well, Taylor asks, in 500 years, we now arrive today, and it's not the default setting. It's actually, it seems to be quite the opposite. We have hurdles to overcome and believe in a sort of divine, whatever God it is. We have a hard time believing that. And so Taylor's question is simply, how did we get there? Because, it, I mean, realistically, 500 years in the history of humanity is a relatively short period of time to make such a drastic shift. So in that book, Taylor coins this phrase he calls the social imaginary. And the social imaginary, you can think of it as it's a sort of set of institutions and values and practices that sort of give shape and help people perceive what is the collective good life or vision of the good life. And social imaginary, it's more than a worldview because it's shared more in the kind of fabric of what it means to be human in a given time. And Taylor's idea is that what happened around the Industrial Revolution that we talked about last week is that something in the social imaginary shifted. It says where before, 500 years ago, the social imaginary found, we would collectively believe you found meaning and purpose in the divine. That was the source of your identity and meaning. But something has happened around the Industrial Revolution where the social imaginary shifted and we are less defined by the divine world as we are now by the world of what he says is commerce. That when the Industrial Revolution came into place and machines were inserted into kind of the production process, what shifted was now meaning and purpose was not in the divine, but it was rather in how much you can produce, how much you can make, how much you can consume. It's the product or the problem of acceleration that we talked about last week. Right? The world we live in, a world based on a social imaginary of commerce, says you are what you produce, you are what you make, and you are what you consume. And so naturally, to achieve, to grow, to rise above that, you have to do more and more and more and more. We are driven by this need, this incessant need to achieve, accomplish, and accumulate. And it's those sorts of things that is the very reason why when you're watching this, you're probably a little bit tired. Because you are on that rat race. You are chasing after speed and production more and more. And you are what you produce and consume. This is the very social imaginary of our day and age. And what happens when the free market takes the place of the divine is we begin to allow that to occupy every part of our thinking and our being. A few years ago, an author, Andrew Sullivan, who isn't a believer, wrote an article that he entitled, I Used to Be Human, And I've referenced this article before. I think it's a very profound piece. But in there, he talks about, and he's kind of reflecting on Taylor's understanding of the shift of the social imaginary. And he writes this. He says, the smartphone revolution of the past decade can be seen in some ways simply as the final twist of this ratchet, in which those few remaining redoubts of quiet, the tiny cracks of inactivity in our lives, are being methodically filled with more stimulus and noise. You see, he opens this piece and he talks about how he, consumed with the digital life, consumed with what he says here, the smartphone revolution, he finally got to the point where it was too much. And for his own sanity, he said, I got to step out of the machine. And so he writes almost kind of grotesquely about how he checked himself into a monastery one day for a silence and solitude retreat. Again, he's not a believer. And he writes about when he sent his smartphone down or checked it in before the retreat, he had sort of panicked pangs where he felt notifications going off and he kept kind of reaching for his phone. And in that, he's exposing this sort of what he calls distraction sickness, where his life and every moment of quiet has been so consumed with noise and more and more and go and achieve. He had bought into that social imaginary. A little later in the piece, he writes this. He says, and yet, reflecting on that busy chaos of the pace of life, he says, and yet our need for quiet has never fully gone away. Because our practical achievements, however spectacular, never quite fulfill us. They are always giving way to new wants and needs, always requiring updating or repairing, always falling short. The mania of our online lives reveal this. We keep swiping and swiping, but we're never truly satisfied. The myth of the modern world, the myth of our social imaginary, is that we can find purpose and meaning in commerce, in consumption, in production. And what Sullivan realizes is the reason that we keep swiping and swiping is this finite thing, commerce, is trying to fill an infinite need or desire. This is again David in Solomon in Ecclesiastes. He says eternity has been placed in the heart of man. And what happens is over and over, we run to these finite things to fill infinite desire, and it always falls short because it can never bear the weight of what our deepest desire is. But we continue to overfreight these things more and more, with more meaning, more purpose, but they cannot satisfy. So we're tired and we're broken. But there's another piece where a different author I talked about said that we almost have, though, this sort of Stockholm syndrome to our very distracted digital lives. The idea that we are captive by this sort of distraction, but yet that Stockholm syndrome means we willfully give ourselves over to it. Because I think for many of us, to say no to that, to sit in the quiet, to resist that pace of life, it's a bit frightening. It actually feels a little more terrifying, because then we'd have to sit with ourselves. Now, what I want to present today is really just this one point. It's that we become what we give our attention to. And what the modern world and the modern social imaginary does is it fills every moment of your attentiveness to something. And it fills us, and you become what you give your attention to. And so when we look on the social landscape, what we find is that when we give our fullest attention to something like and fill every small crack of silence with social media or entertainment or whatever it is, those sorts of things get inscribed into us and we slowly become those things. And so is it any wonder that when we consume social media over and over, that that then inscribes itself within us and the very anxiety and fear that we see in those things we become? Because we are, we become what we give our attention to. See, what we need is some sort of way out of that sort of chaos. We need to lift our lives out of the mess of the modern world that insists on more and more and find a sort of life with God that can resist that pull and find a different way. And well, we have good news. There is, in fact, a way to do that. So if you have your Bibles, why don't you flip to Psalm chapter 27. In Psalm 27, we're going to just look at the first four verses. It's a short text for today. And what we're going to see in these four verses is that just like there's no new problem under the sun, that these are sorts of issues that, yes, have a different flavor and flair for our modern day, but they're solutions of followers of Jesus and God before us. And we see this with David as well. So Psalm 27, let's start in verse 1. David says, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When the wicked advance against me to devour me, it is my enemies and my foes who will stumble and fall. Though an army besiege me, my heart will not fear. Though war break out against me, even then I will be confident." You see, David opens this in verse 1 and he says, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is my stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid?" See, David begins with this sort of assertion of when God is the center attentive point of my mind, when I hold God there, he is my light. He is my salvation. But yet right after that, you see this tension that David's in verses 2 and 3, you see him sort of in this battle, this sort of tension. He says, there's also though this wicked that are advancing against me. There's enemies and foes, and they're coming on towards me. There's war breaking out around me. You see, the image David gives is of this sort of, when I give my attentiveness to God, he's my light and my salvation. He says, but I look over here and there's this pole, this where the enemies, the war that's breaking out. He says, that's drawing my attention away. And he's caught in this sort of tension. Now, most of us are not in a sort of a war in the same way that David was. We're not in a physical war in that sense. There's not enemies sitting outside your door. But all of us feel this pull for our attentiveness. All of us feel pulled in this direction that you have to be this or achieve this or accomplish this. And this sort of chaos of that problem of acceleration, this problem of the social imaginary of commerce, that you are what you produce, all of these things are pulling on us. We can feel this sort of tension. We feel this sort of battle for our focus and our mind. It was the Nobel laureate Herbert Simon who coined the phrase the attention economy. Now, if you missed that day in high school economics, I am no expert, but let me bring you back up to speed. Economics is the study of how scarce resources are distributed. And what Herbert Simon is saying is he says, we now live in the attention economy. And he says, there are people vying for the scarce resource of your attentiveness. And so in that, we have people who want to pull and monetize and exploit our very attentiveness. There are high stakes where if they can get your eyes locked on their particular feed or stream or whatever, there's all sorts of money to be made on that. There's chaos. There's people pulling you one direction and the next. They're vying. There's a battle going on in this attention economy. And the problem is, again, we become what we give our attentiveness to. A few years ago, Jonathan Haidt wrote an article called "Why the Past 10 Years of American Life Have Been Uniquely Stupid," and I think he needs a hug. But this article he's a social psychologist who draws almost a direct line between time spent on social media and the sort of outrage culture we see nowadays. And he says what happens is the more we've seen social media kind of rise, we've seen this rise of fear and anxiety. And see, what I see over and over is as we live in a culture where rage and fear and anxiety sells and goes viral, in an attention economy, these things are how we distribute those scarce resources. And so we become more and more consumed with them. We give more and more of our attentiveness to them. And then you look out over the landscape of our society and you see a rising mental health problem, and it's crushing our young people because we're allowing fear and anxiety to hold our attentiveness. And listen, you are becoming what you give your attentiveness to. You're becoming what you give your attention to. So as a culture, we're giving our attention to fear and outrage and all of these things that may or may not be worth our time, but they seem to be reifying themselves into us. We're becoming the very things that we're frightened by. David goes on, though, and he offers a solution to this, because the question we have to ask is, how do we lift again ourselves out of this? How do we get out of that sort of turmoil and chaos? How do we push against the attention economy, this chaos of war around us? Because again, David senses that. If I fix my eyes on God, he's my light and my salvation. But if I allow myself to see the enemies and the chaos around me, well, those things begin to encroach on me. Look down at verse 4, because again, David has a solution for this. One thing I ask from the Lord, this only do I seek. One thing, right? Think about that. One thing, the one thing that David desires out of all of this. The goal isn't, well, if we just get the right person elected and my party in place, then I'll overcome the chaos, I'll overcome my enemies, I'll destroy them. Or if we just get a hold on this particular avenue of culture, and if we just get influence here, then we can coerce all of culture into the way we want. No, like David says, the one thing that he seeks, the one thing to overcome this chaos, he says, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze on the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple. See, the one thing David sees out of this chaos is not to conquer, to coerce, to overcome, to gain influence and power over, and all these sorts of things that we too often buy into. He says, the one thing I desire is that I may dwell in the house of the Lord forever, that I can gaze and behold the beauty of the Lord. Now, David was the king of Israel. So he was awfully busy. It wasn't that he was literally saying, I want to sit in the sanctuary just day after day for eternity. He's speaking more about a manner of living in which you can live about your, go about your regular days, aware and connected to the very presence of God. I think this is what Paul talks about when he says, pray continually. You see, Paul didn't mean that you're just constantly with your hands folded and your eyes shut, just reciting some sort of prayer. But rather for Paul, there was some way, for David, there was some way in which you could go about your day conscious of and aware of God's presence. You could dwell in the Lord in a manner that could be just like your everyday life. And David says, this is the one thing I desire. And so we're still getting to this sort of practicality, and David actually gets us very practical. He says, there's two things you can do. The first is to dwell. He says, I want to dwell in the house of the Lord. And the Hebrew word for this is the word yeshab. And it means to sit or to remain or to dwell. It's actually very similar to the word that we talked about last week, meno in Greek, which is to remain. It has a connotation of finding your life in or finding your home in this person. David says, I want to dwell. I want to yeshab in the house of the Lord forever. You see, this is the path of transformation for David. And it's the path of transformation for you and I as well, is when we dwell in the very presence of God, what happens is that begins to transform us from the inside out. Last week, I used this example of a sponge, and I think it's a good one. We're permeable people, meaning we are meant, like a sponge is meant to be permeated with water, so too we are meant to be permeated with something. And I think what happens is more often than not, we're permeated with things less than God, but we were created to be permeated with the very Holy Spirit. And what happens when you're permeated by something is when you are squeezed like a sponge, whatever fills you flows out of you. And so for us to dwell in the house of the Lord forever is a way in which we can be permeated with God's presence, so that when you are permeated with that, when that is squeezed, what comes out of you is the very presence of God. All right, and so when we dwell in the house of the Lord, when we make our home in God, what happens is where you once found yourself resentful, because that's not of God, when you were once resentful, you find yourself full of forgiveness. Where you were once greedy, you find yourself generous, because that's God coming out of this, the goodness of God flowing out of you. Where you were once selfish, you become selfless. Because now what is in you is God. It's the very goodness of God coming out of you. I think about that teaching of Jesus. Remember when he said, bless those who curse you. And I think what he means by that is not to like muster the willpower to do that, but rather if you have blessing within you, when someone curses you, blessing will come out of you. But if you have cursing in you, then when someone curses you, what comes out is cursing. And we don't often think of it in these terms, but this usually plays out far more when we're hiding behind a screen, typing about that other person or tweeting about this or posting about that. As if there's cursing in us, if what holds our attention is the sort of outrage and fear and anxiety and anger of something like your Twitter stream, well then as that fills and permeates you, of course that's going to start coming out of you. Because we are becoming what we give our attention to. And if we are constantly filling every moment of quiet with that, well, that's going to come out of us. You become what you give your attention to. But then David says there's this other thing you can do. So the first is to dwell in the house of the Lord forever. That's what he desires. And when he dwells in the house of the Lord, he says, then I can behold or gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. And the Hebrew word here is chazah, and it means to see, or again, the translation I really like is behold. And David's getting at this is when I'm finally in the house of the Lord, I can behold God. I can see God. I can gaze upon his beauty. I can fix him as the center of my attention. And when we do this, when we behold God, we ultimately start becoming like that. You are becoming what you give your attention to. You're becoming what you're beholding. And see, all of us have this sort of desire to behold. To behold is to worship, and to be human is to worship. You cannot not worship. We are all beholding something. It's to be human. And my fear is this, is that for many of us, we behold social media. And so what we become is filled with comparison and envy. We behold politics or politicians. As we behold them, we become people who are power hungry and lustful for coercion and control. We behold the news and media and entertainment, and what we slowly become is anxious and fearful because you become what you give your attention to. And these things are inscribing themselves into us, and slowly they're giving shape to our identity and the way in which we live in the world. And if I'm honest, they begin to just bleed out over everyone around us. See, one of my problems, or one of the reasons I think that we avoid beholding God, is so many of us bring these wrongful images of who God is. And so we have these images of God that he's angry, that he's frustrated, that he's waiting around the corner for you to screw up so he can punish you and can curse you and pour this all out on you. And so why would we want to behold that kind of God? But what David says is, no, the God I behold is beautiful. And whatever image it is that you have of God is going to give shape to how you behold God. And if you have that wrong image of God, of an angry father, maybe it reflects the father of your own childhood, and you begin to project that onto God, well, that's going to be devastating. So in some ways, we need to behold this beautiful God who is our loving father. Maybe if it isn't that, some of us behold and keep at the center of our attention the sort of scars and wounds that life has inscribed upon us. For many of us, we've had broken things happen to us. We've had things of injustice that never should have happened to you, and they scar you, and they become the thing in which you behold, and that is slowly giving shape to your life. And the whole time, God is sitting there saying, no, let me take those from you. But these wounds and these scars, they go deep. If they're left undealt with, they become the very identity markers of our life. And God is saying, let you come into the house of the Lord, dwell in my house, behold me, and let me heal these broken areas. So many of us wrestle with these and the onslaught of the digital age that's marked by systems and structures and algorithms that keep forcing these painful images upon us. And as we give more and more of our attentiveness to them, racing from one thing to the next, never allowing ourselves to explore our own inner life, they become the very things that give identity to us. We become what we give our attentiveness to. And David says the one thing The one thing I ask, the one thing I seek is that I can dwell in the house of the Lord forever, that I can gaze upon his beauty, I can behold God. Because here's what happens is when we behold God, beholding God deconstructs the false images of the self that have slowly over time been internalized to the place where they have become the organizing principle and give shape to our identity and our lives. But beholding God chips away at those. It deconstructs those. It cuts away, allowing us to find our true identity and meaning in where it should have been found all along in God. All those lies, all those misses, it is deconstructing that brokenness. It's allowing us to become something different. When we behold God, we become more and more like God. We become Christ-like. We get in union with God. The one thing he asks, the one thing he desires, is to dwell in the house of the Lord all of his days and to behold the beauty of God. Now, I think if we're honest, we still haven't quite answered the question, how? How do we dwell in the house of the Lord? How do we behold God? Well, I want to end with a few very simple, practical ways to do that. But before, let me read this quote by Dallas Willard in his great book, The Great Omission. Willard says, "The first and most basic thing that we can and must do is keep God before our minds. This is the fundamental secret of caring for our souls. Our part in thus practicing the presence of God is to direct and redirect our minds constantly to him. Soon our minds will return to God as the needle of a compass returns to the north. If God is the great longing of our souls, he will become the pole star of our inward being." I love that. Willard says, the first and most basic thing of being an apprentice of Jesus, the first and most fundamental thing we can and must do is simply keep God before our minds. He says, this is the fundamental secret of caring for your souls. All of that brokenness, all of that pain that we carry, all of the ways in which we have distorted how we're to go about life. Willard says, David says, Jesus says, behold God. Keep God before your mind. And I love that line when he says, you must just redirect, and then he knows we'll get distracted. So then we redirect our minds back to God. I heard a pastor this week that was getting frustrated with the way in their prayer life they were, they'd constantly be distracted. And the phrase they say is like 1,000 times I'd be distracted in prayer. And he was telling this to his spiritual director, and his spiritual director responded and said, listen, that sounds like 1,000 more ways to return to God. I really like that image, because if you're like me, for most of us, our minds just are racing. And when we slow down, we're distracted over and over. That your minds are doing what they've been trained to do. But if we're to behold God, all we have to do is direct and then redirect. Continue to bring our minds back to God. This is how we behold God. So if we're to do this, I think there's 4 things that can help us in this. I think the first is that we have to create margin. I mean this quite literally. I, as a pastor, am worried that I'm often too busy to follow Jesus. I mean, the myth of the modern world of a social imaginary that speaks of commerce as our identity markers, we have to go and go and go and produce and produce. Right? Think about that familiar scene, right? You're in the grocery store, you've got everything, you come up to the register, you stop in line, and what's the first thing you do? You reach for your phone. Because you want to distract yourself. You want to do something. We can't just step into that. But there's this thing they used to do in the 90s. It was crazy. They'd pull up in their carts, they'd stand in line, and then they'd just stand there. They'd just wait. And these little moments in our life became pockets in which we were able to become attentive to where we are and maybe even where God is, even in the grocery store. But these moments that have been now crowded out by a digital life and a digital world that's invaded every nook and cranny of our attentiveness is slowly over time speeding up our internal life in a way that's filling our attentiveness. So instead of a moment of boredom and a moment of margin, it's become a moment where we scroll through the outrage culture of whatever it is. We're becoming what we give our attention to. in this idea of creating margin. You know, next week we're starting a series on silence and solitude. And the whole idea with silence and solitude is that we step into a habit that enables us to just create room for God. Again, there's a direct connection. We'll talk about this next week, but there's a direct connection between our ability to sit in silence with someone and our intimacy with them. I can sit in a room with Lindsay and be utterly silent for hours, and it's not awkward because there's an intimacy that I have with her. But if you and I were to get in a car and drive to Nevada or something like that, I imagine I would start talking pretty quick because I don't know you as well. And we feel that awkwardness. What if this is true of our relationship with God? What if part of the reason we can't sit in silence with God is because we're not quite as familiar with God and as intimate with God as we actually believed? So next week, we're going to start a series where for 6 months, we're going to practice silence and solitude as a community. We're going to start to integrate this into our lives to simply just fight against the hurry and the distraction of our social imaginary. And then in the spring, we're going to start this practice or this habit of Sabbath. And Sabbath is simply one day a week where you just resist the sort of incessant pull towards accomplishment and accumulation. The word Sabbath is Shabbat. It literally means just to stop. And what you do on Sabbath is it's a sort of small act of resistance against having to do more and produce more and become more and this or that. It's simply a way in which you just say, I'm more than that. No. And in that, we create margin for God to begin to permeate us. We begin to dwell and behold God because we've created room in our lives to do those things. And if we can't create room for that, well, then it gets filled with something. And again, you are becoming what you give your attention to. You're becoming what you give your attention to. So the first thing we have to do if we're to dwell in the house of the Lord, if we're to behold God's beauty, is we must create margin. But the second thing is we have to embrace boredom and slowing. Listen, when I began this practice of Sabbath, it was stunning how bored I became very quickly. We're used to, like I said, in the grocery store, filling every moment with something to stimulate our minds. But if we're going to create margin to dwell in the house of the Lord, to behold God, we have to embrace boredom. Boredom is not a bad thing. It's a way for us to disconnect from the machine of the modern world that demands that humans bear more than they're meant to. It's an act of resistance against the always go, always on world. Boredom and slowing creates a rhythm in which we can slow ourselves down in a way to just become aware of the world around us. When we embrace boredom and slowing, when we create margin through silence and solitude and Sabbath, really what we're doing is we're releasing control. We're simply just saying, God, I'm going to stop and it's going to be okay. See, I think most of the time, the reason that we can't slow down, the reason we avoid and pull out our phones or watch this or that or constantly fill our lives with noise is because most of us are afraid of what we'll find when we stop. And so we fill it with something. And that is slowly becoming who we are becoming. So what if we just embraced boredom? What if we embraced slowing down? The third thing we have to learn to do is we have to learn to practice the presence of God. And I stole this phrase from a 17th century monk, Brother Lawrence, who has this beautiful little book. It's maybe 75, 80 pages. I can't encourage it enough. But in this little book, he talks about how he is a Catholic, which remember, for Catholics, the Eucharist, the communion table, was the high point of their spirituality. And in this book, he has this great line where he says, what I found as I practiced the presence of God, says, what I found as I dwelt or beheld God was that I was no less in the presence of God when he was doing dishes in the chaos of the kitchen than when he was at the blessed Eucharist. See, there's a way in which we can live aware of the presence of God, where whatever the mundane things of your life are, whether it's folding laundry or commuting in traffic or dropping the kids off at school or cooking dinner or meeting with a friend or whatever it is, those things can be opportunities and moments in which you practice the presence of God. You recognize God's presence with you. Right, think of that moment in Exodus where Moses is by the burning bush and then God says, hey, why don't you take your sandals off because where you're standing is holy ground? See, the ground didn't just get holy. Moses became aware of it. God's presence is available to us at all times. We simply have to learn to become more aware of it. So we have to learn to practice the presence of God. For me, this looks simple. It often means just before I step into a meeting or coffee with a friend or whatever it is, I tend to just try to create a rhythm where I just kind of slow down and just simply say, God, I am here and so are you. And I say a simple prayer just like that, and then I step into whatever it is. It's a subtle way to remind myself, a practice that I can slowly remind myself that God is present. He's here. I'm just joining with what he's doing. And so we have to learn to practice the presence of God. And then lastly, and I think most importantly, is we have to recognize that all of this is grace. All of this is grace. Because in the act of letting go, the act of slowing down, the act of dwelling in the house of the Lord, of beholding God, is really only in response to God. See, what you find is when you behold God, what you find in that is as you see him, as you gaze on the beauty of the Lord, what happens is you find that God the whole time has been beholding you. He's been looking at you, not with angry eyes, but more of that posture of the father and the prodigal son who's running down the driveway to embrace his son who's made a mess of life. It's God is always beholding you and I. He's looking at his children with love. When we behold God, all we are doing is beholding God, beholding us. My youngest daughter, who's 6, is playing soccer this year. And it's been a tougher year for her and her soccer team. We'll see if she ends up wanting to play next year or not. But she does this thing where in the middle of the game, she'll be running around the field and it's all sorts of chaos. And every once in a while, you can see a little bit of anxiety rise up in her and she gets a little nervous and timid. And she does this thing where she looks over at Lindsay and I. And when she finds that we're looking at her, we're beholding her, she gets this little grin on her face and she begins to run a little harder. Because there's something about when mom and dad are beholding you, when they're looking at you, where you're reminded that everything's going to be okay. God is constantly beholding us. He's not angry. He's not hiding around the corner. He's not waiting for you to screw up. He's not wanting and seeking punishment and revenge and vengeance against you. God is a good God, a father who has his arms open, that is just wanting to behold us. He's looking at us with eyes of love. And when we slow down and behold that, we become what we give our attention to. When we behold the love of God becomes the animating part of our life. It becomes the thing in which is permeating us. So, church, my hope is that we can become a people who learn to dwell in the house of the Lord, that we can learn to behold God beholding us. David ends this psalm in verse 13 and 14, and he says this. He says, I remain confident of this. Remember, it's in the midst of that sort of chaos of everything going around, the enemies, the wars breaking out, all of that. He says, I remain confident of this, that I will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and take heart and wait for the Lord. Church, may we become a people who are willing to wait for the Lord. Because we recognize in that waiting, in that slow, mundane thing, God is slowly transforming us from the inside out. As we dwell in the house of the Lord and we sit in his presence, as we behold God, what's happening is God is actually transforming you from the inside out. He's filling you not with anger and rage, but something akin to love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, and self-control. It's the life we desire. May we learn to behold God because we understand that we are becoming what we give our attention to.